This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll talk with PNC Financial Services Group economist Kurt Rankin about how the semi-annual survey of small and mid-sized Indiana business owners and executives turned out. We'll find out how Northwest Indiana and the rest of the state fared as far as its neighboring states here in the Midwest. Also, it's another edition of Green Fleet Radio with your host, Carl Lissick. And a little later, it's Lakeshore Focus host Keith Kirkpatrick with his interview with the Diocese of Gary Bishop Donald Hying. That and more coming up, but first, the news. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Some of the figures coming out from not only across Indiana, but around the country as well. Notes of optimism, continued optimism from some fronts. The National Federation of Independent Businesses is talking about increased optimism among its members, the small and mid-sized businesses across the country, as well as in Indiana. And now we have more reports coming out too. PNC Bank is continuing its semi-annual survey of small and mid-sized business owners and executives around the state and around the country, for that matter, too. And they're also noting some signs of optimism, but there are some problems in Indiana. Let's find out more about it here, about the report here. Kurt Rankin is vice president, and he's an economist for PNC Bank. He's based out of Pittsburgh. Kurt, thanks very much for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about how PNC Bank puts all this information together, the data that they sift out, and what, in particular, interesting things you all have noted about Indiana's economic situation and how that fits in with small and mid-sized businesses.
Well, as you mentioned, the survey is of small and mid-sized businesses. Generally, that's employers with fewer than 500 employees. Mm-hmm. And we do this for retail footprints across PNC's territories, so from the Mississippi River over to the coast, at basically as far south as St. Louis, Nashville. But I specifically cover the upper Midwest economies, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio. So you mentioned problems mm-hmm. for Indiana's economy as opposed to the national economy, at least as far as these survey results go. But they're good problems to have.
Yeah.
Indiana's employment growth has slowed a bit after outpacing the nation, the Midwest average, pretty much any benchmark you could apply, since 2012, 2013. That was bound to slow. Labor force has also slowed. The statewide number was essentially flat in 2017. So as these small mid-sized businesses were surveyed for these results, it's not surprising that some may not have as much optimism in terms of being able to hire because labor force is getting tight in Indiana.
It's interesting that the data shows that, and then we know there have been some economists that talk about that too. They're concerned about the fact that even though the unemployment rate is lower, that the workforce is out there, but it's not right up to snuff, and that's what they want to be able to be sure that Indiana is able to have the right people that are qualified for the right jobs, as they're not only developing at the time, but for the future as well too, I would imagine.
Right, Indiana's going to have to battle places like Michigan, especially Southwest Michigan, but also Detroit, in terms of attracting new talent, with labor force flat in Indiana in 2017, so that could have been the result of retirements, that could have been a result of different demographic forces, but generally, Indiana, just as the job base was growing, the labor force was also growing above average. But now Indiana's flat labor force growth for 2017 compares to Michigan and Ohio, which both outpaced Indiana in attracting new workers, either from existing households that might not have been counted in the labor force previously, or by attracting new workers from outside the region. But the unemployment rate is so exceptionally low across the state of Indiana that attracting new talent from outside of the state may be the next necessary step. And business owners that are asked about this sort of thing, whether they're asked about the prospect of hiring or what that will mean for the wages they're going to have to pay, that's going to have not a dampening effect on spirits, but certainly going to temper optimism in terms of whether that can even be achieved. It's going to be a tougher, longer search than it might have been 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Was there any way for anybody to be able to predict this situation may happen? I know obviously everybody was keeping a close eye on the figures and unemployment rates in particular and watching them get adjusted, but is there something that maybe that might have been, should have been thought of maybe a few months ago or even a few years ago to be ready for this situation?
Well, the unemployment rate's been falling consistently, steadily, and not just on individuals not looking for work, which is one reason the unemployment rate could artificially fall. The unemployment rate in Indiana has been falling steadily from a very high level in some cases in Fort Wayne and in South Bend, the northern part of the state. So with an unemployment rate that's consistently falling despite more people entering the labor force and with jobs being created at the pace they were, it was something that could have, yes, easily been foreseen if you're looking at the labor market data, but not prevented. You can't. No one's going to stop creating jobs, nor would anyone want to, just because it's getting more difficult to find qualified workers. That's a national phenomenon. Indiana just happens to be a bit ahead of the curve in terms of using up its labor force slack or labor force supply. That just creates the hurdle of attracting new talent. That's not a problem, except that it's going to make those employers maybe have to raise wages a bit more than they might have wanted to if they want to attract or potentially even retain their existing talent, because if everyone's looking for jobs in the region, or everyone's looking for employers to fill their jobs in the region, Indiana's going to have to worry about other regions, other states poaching their talent.
One of the interesting facts that came out in all of this was that we've talked here about it briefly as well, about Indiana having trouble trying to find qualified employees and for employers, small and middle-sized employees, in particular, employers in particular, to be able to find these employees. It's 43% is the figure here in Indiana, and that's a little higher even than the national average, is it not?
If you break this down by regions of the state, Indianapolis's wage growth was essentially flat in 2017. Some of that has to do with industry mix. If you're adding lower wage jobs as opposed to higher wage jobs, then wages are going to grow more slowly. Mm-hmm. But you look at more manufacturing intensive regions in the state, Fort Wayne in particular, which had the strongest wage growth in 2017 for the areas that PNC covers, wages were strongly up. So even if Indiana's having more trouble than the national average in terms of sourcing new labor talent, the answer to that may have to be rising wages rising more rapidly than they already have. That's going to be tough to do in a manufacturing centric economy that's already seen strong wage growth, but Indianapolis is diverse enough that wage growth could be stronger, and the economy is diverse enough that it could attract a broader industry base of jobs, and all of those jobs could see stronger wage growth, but the options are becoming limited as to how employers in the state of Indiana are going to be able to attract new labor force talent.
Now, you mentioned earlier in our conversation, talking about how things are improving in sections of Michigan, and what kind of impact do you see compared to these other states around us, that problems that Indiana can take advantage of and get some ideas if they haven't gotten them already to be able to improve the lot for not only for small and mid-sized businesses in the state, but also for the people that would like to work for these companies?
I don't know what on-the-ground platforms, ideas that are being thrown around in Southwest Michigan, for example, but the employment growth is as strong as it was in Indiana before Indiana started to slow. Ohio is doing well, but was never doing as well as Indiana, so there's different environments that each of those states are facing. Indiana's, as the phrase I used earlier, ahead of the curve. Even if there are policies going into place that are helping Southwest Michigan continue its strong job growth, Indiana was out ahead of that. So maybe what could work while the economy's still reaching the strength of Indiana's in Southwest Michigan, Indiana's past that point, so maybe a new policy might be called for, but workforce development, those sort of incentives to attract new businesses into the region are always going to be welcome, but really where the rubber meets the road is existing employers who want to expand, who want to take advantage of the strong economy, expanding themselves as opposed to relying on new policies to help them do that, and that's going to come down to their ability and their willingness to pay for that expansion, and that means wages.
Okay. I know, Kurt, in the past here, governors here in Indiana in particular have taken advantage of slowing economic conditions, and we'll just say in this case our neighboring state, Illinois, the problems that they have over there, and taking advantage of that to bring businesses across the state line. Are we likely to continue to see that trend based on this, or do you think it's time to start growing more of our own Indiana-based businesses rather than relying on borrowing ideas or better still, taking businesses out of state and bringing them here to Indiana?
Well, I don't know that there's anything in this survey that suggests that borrowing or attracting businesses from Illinois and Chicago specifically, mm-hmm. There's nothing in this survey that suggests that, but that is a reality. That's not just speculation. That's not just the high tax burden in Illinois and specifically in Chicago is forcing or employers are finding it now cost effective to move north of the border to Wisconsin, to move into Indiana. That's not going to change. The fiscal issues in Illinois are not going to change. So maybe that is an opportunity to, if there is the ability for state and local governments to offer incentives, now would be the time to do that when businesses are maybe looking for that opportunity. So that could get some new businesses into the region, but if you can't source the talent to fill those positions in Indiana, that maybe you could in the monstrosities, the economy, yeah. The size of Chicago, having those businesses in the state doesn't do as much good unless you can actually fill the positions.
Well, so do you think maybe in our conversation here, we've been focusing in on a lot of the problems that Indiana has been dealing with here with this the lower unemployment rate, but the slower opportunities that businesses can rely on to fill the positions that they happen to have available. Do you think that we're still, I guess, in closing, pretty much still looking pretty optimistic, I guess, as far as chances of things improving in Indiana and with the right policies this gets turned around?
Yes, optimism should not be dented significantly just because it's going to be more difficult to hire. Indiana's optimism index, according to our survey, is usually pretty stable across the board. I find that these survey results tell us that small business owners in Indiana are more cautious. Even when things are going well, they're cautious as to whether they're going to continue to go to conditions are going to continue to remain as strong as they are now, or if things are looking up for the future. There's a bit more caution in embracing that prospect, sort of a wait and see attitude. This is just coming out of survey results, so small business owners are by their nature risk takers. So it may be a matter of what's being communicated versus what they're thinking on the ground. But just because conditions are going to be a little tougher to navigate doesn't mean that optimism should be significantly dented. The economy is strong in Indiana. All signs point to that continuing across the state. The economic fundamentals aren't about to change. Household finances are going to remain strong. Employers are going to continue to look to hire. And as far as households go, if those employers do look to hire and do come to the realization that rising wages is the only way to get that done, that means that those same households are going to have more money in their wallets to spend. That's going to create more jobs. That's a virtuous cycle that Indiana can probably count on for the foreseeable future.
Kurt Rankin is vice president. He's an economist for the PNC Financial Services Group, and PNC does an annual survey, semi-annual actually, of small and mid-sized business owners and executives in Indiana, and they've come up with some very optimistic plans for the future and to continue on growing. And Kurt, thank you very much for spending some time to talk about this, and we'll keep an eye on the economy here in Indiana and continue to hope for the best.
Thank you, Chris. It was nice to talk to you.
It's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Therese Haller. She's the executive director of the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. Therese, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today, Carl.
You know, I just wanted to first start out by congratulating you on the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District winning the South Shore Clean Cities Excellence in Environmental Education Award at a recent annual meeting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure that I took the opportunity to say really fully how grateful we are to be honored and recognized by our peers in the environmental education and advocacy arena. We really appreciate that. We're all working really hard to get our messages out, but it's nice to know that our peers are recognizing us for that. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome and well-deserving, and I know you're doing some great things, but you know, a lot of our listeners are not familiar with the Recycling and Waste Reduction District. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. We are actually a government agency, and our mission is to improve the environment and quality of life for our residents in Porter County and in the region by providing environmental education and programs that are voluntary. And it offers individuals the opportunity to first reduce the amount of waste they're creating through our education efforts. But then when they do have waste, we have alternative recycling and disposal options, keeping waste out of landfill and our environment.
Which is amazing. Because, again, since I've been involved with South Shore Clean Cities, it just seems like our recycling rates continue to improve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something with green buildings and, you know, everything that's going on within the industry. It's just wonderful to see this going on right here in Porter County. So, you know, congratulations on the great work that you do. So I know you've got a lot of exciting things that are taking place. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the Northwest Indiana Earth Day and Reuse Fair?
Sure. Every year around Earth Day being April 22nd, we always try to hit a Saturday prior to that day to have a day where it's a family-oriented event where the families and participants can come in and hear from vendors, exhibitors that have products, services, or message about reducing our individual impact on the environment. So we're really excited. This is our 13th year for the event. It's free. It's from 9 to 2 at the Porter County Expo on Saturday, April 21st. And we encourage families to come out and participate in that. And we've incorporated an additional service at that day. We think we'll encourage more people to come out and participate. It's a reuse fair. Mm-hmm. And we have invited not-for-profits to tell us what types of products they would like from residents that are not new,
okay,
but something that you or I might think about discarding, but these not-for-profits can use these products. For example, some really really quirky item that I just love to talk about is we have a zoo that actually is looking for perfumes. Because
really?
Some of their animals react positively to having that perfume scent. So that's one of the items on the reuse fair. So people can find that information about what we're looking for, and it's dozens of items. So it's too much to talk about here. But they can go to our website.
And again, it's a great event. We've been attending. We've been participating with this event. And every year it gets bigger. It just seems like, you know, it's really something that a lot of our residents look forward to attending. And, you know, some of the youth that have come, you know, that are actually working at this. I know that for a fact. So it's been a great opportunity for our local area. And I know it includes all the counties. It's not just Porter County. You work with a multitude of the other county solid waste districts.
Yes, our neighboring districts from LaPorte and Lake County also participate in various ways at the event, supporting us there. And again, it's Northwest Indiana, as you pointed out. That's the name of the event, Northwest Indiana Earth Day Celebration.
So I also know that you have a household hazardous waste collection starting in May. And how do those work?
Well, basically, you're right. We start in May. Our first collection is Saturday, May 12th. All of our collections are on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. They're from 9 to 2. And basically, it's a drive-through program. So we're looking to aid residents in properly disposing of hazardous chemicals in the home that might be poisonous, toxic, corrosive. We certainly want to keep those out of landfills and our water system. So this is a drive-through program. You drive up, we remove the material from your vehicle, and you get to drive away.
Wonderful. And so I know you also have public compost sites as well. And I understand that Valparaiso compost, the compost site there in Valpo, has an open house coming up also.
We do. We're waiting to announce that date specifically. We're working on refining that. But we the district, as mm-hmm. an agency, all solid waste districts, we're officially a solid waste district. That's our government agency name. We have been around for well over 20 years, and mm-hmm. we've been working in a great partnership with the city of Valparaiso at that compost site. However, I think still a lot of people don't know who we are. Mm. We try a lot of different channels to get our message out. So we came up with the idea to have an open house to try to get people that don't know about that site to come up there and see what happens there. It's a great program up there, a great partnership with the city. We are recycling your leaves and making compost for you to put back into your garden. So it is completing the full circle.
Absolutely.
Here in Valparaiso.
Wonderful. And then where can our listeners learn more about all of your services and events that are coming up?
Certainly, they can visit our website at www.portercountyrecycling.com. .org, and that's spelled out fully.
Okay. And any closing thoughts as we wrap up our program, Therese?
I just want to encourage people to check out our website and find out about all the services that are available to them through our agency, because they are funding it.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly like to take every opportunity to say to people, you're already paying for these services
sure.
on your taxes. So please find out what you're paying for and use them. And collectively, we're going to be all in a better spot if you use these services.
And it's wonderful. Congratulations again on all the great services that you're providing and all the upcoming events. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Therese Haller. She's the Executive Director of Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District here in Valparaiso. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you, everybody.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And you can hear podcasts of the Green Fleet Radio on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. The chairman of the revamped board to coordinate Indiana's job training program says fixing the organizational chart will make all the programs more effective.
Danny Lopez says the 21-member workforce cabinet will connect workers with employers, though it's too early to say what specific steps it'll take.
The governor is working on seating the cabinet, and we're working on developing operationally what it is that we're going to be hammering home at the granular level.
But Lopez says the board will work to make sure students know what careers are out there and what they need to be qualified for them. And because his post reports directly to the governor, Lopez says he'll be better positioned not only to coordinate training programs, but to work with other agencies on issues which affect the workforce, from addiction to transportation. Eric Berman, Network Indiana.
Seven positions are predetermined, including the state school superintendent and the presidents of Ivy Tech and Vincennes University. Governor Holcomb is appointing the other 14 members, and Lopez's selection is the only one of those made so far. Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush participated in a national panel discussion on legal issues in the opioid epidemic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports the panel met in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday to focus on common challenges.
Chief Justice Loretta Rush co-chairs the National Judicial Opioid Task Force to examine the impacts of the opioid crisis on the justice system. At the Legal Services Corporation's annual forum, Rush spoke about the need to understand the epidemic from a health angle.
Some of the key goals we have for the National Judicial Task Force are to educate our judges. Because one thing we know as judges is the science of addiction.
Rush says in over 20 years as a judge, she's never seen a crisis like this. Other panelists included judges from other states and legal experts. The discussion covered family law, child neglect cases, a lack of services, and other related issues. Participants also underlined the need to collaborate more. Issues often crisscross different areas of the law. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Originally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Lakeshore Focus host Keith Kirkpatrick invited the Diocese of Gary Bishop Donald J. Hying into the studio for his program recently to talk about his work and the changes in the Northwest Indiana Diocese since he was installed as bishop. Here's the conversation.
If you are not a practicing Catholic, you may not know the name of the bishop for the Diocese of Gary. He arrived here a few years ago and is the spiritual leader for the largest church body in Northwest Indiana. I'm sure he has some interesting observations about our region and what he is facing today. Oh yes, his name? Bishop Donald Hying. Glad to have you on the show.
It's great to be on your show, Keith. Thank you.
Well, I told people I was going to start the show with a confession, since I just felt compelled to confess. I guess, do you just bring that out in people, that they need to confess?
I hope so.
So, you know, Dan Lowry, who is a good practicing Catholic, used to be the host of this show.
I didn't know that.
So, you know, in my pride, when I'm with Dan, I always tell him that my show is much better than his. Is that a confessable sin, you think?
I think it is, and your penance is to have me back on your show in the future, but I proclaim God's mercy to you, Keith. So.
I feel much better.
Job well done.
I'm not sure that'll stop me from doing it with Dan again, but maybe it should.
That's right.
So you have been here a few years, but before I even get into your background, I'm always curious. So there's got to be a story behind the cross you wear.
Yeah, I received this cross from Pope Benedict the 16th. So every 5 years, bishops go to Rome to report to the Pope on the status of their diocese. And I was auxiliary bishop in 2012 when I went with the Wisconsin bishops. And we met with the Pope in his private library. And at the end of that, each one of us received this cross. So it's a precious memento of that encounter.
Wow. So did he actually touch it, you think?
I don't know. I got it from an aide who took it from a table. He would have blessed them, but he probably didn't personally
touch him. Yeah. But it has the memory of that experience for you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I got to meet Pope Benedict 3 times and Pope Francis 3 times.
Really?
Yeah, over the years.
So are all the bishops able to say that they have that experience?
Yeah, probably. If you're in Rome and you go to the general audience, which is on Wednesdays in St. Peter's Square, as a bishop, you can go sit up on this dais, and then at the end, you get presented to the Pope. You get 30 good seconds to talk to him before you're whisked away. So,
whisked away. So, of any one of those trips, what was maybe your most memorable moment?
Yeah, I would say in 2011, when I first became a bishop, we went to a 9-day conference for new bishops. So all the new bishops from the entire last year came together. It's kind of like bishop school for beginners. And at the end of that, we met Pope Benedict, but we also had a private tour of the Sistine Chapel. So I've been in the Sistine Chapel when it's just jam-packed with tourists and pilgrims and noisy. There were essentially 50 of us in there for an hour with our own private tour guide when the Vatican museums were closed. So that was definitely a highlight.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the bishop school for bishops would be the BS for bishops?
Something like that, right. Or baby bishop school or
baby bishop something. School. Yeah. I kind of like that. So you've been here now a few years. You came from Milwaukee. That's your hometown too,
yeah,
right?
I'm a native of Milwaukee. I grew up there. I went to Marquette University. I attended St. Francis de Sales Seminary in Milwaukee. Was a parish priest for the Archdiocese. Did 4 years of mission work in the Dominican Republic, and then eventually became rector of our seminary there and then auxiliary bishop in 2011. Then at the end of 2014, Pope Francis moved me here.
Wow.
So the rest is history.
So you weren't pried out of Milwaukee. You had already spent 4 years out of the country.
Yes. Yeah, doing mission work. But I never thought I would permanently leave Milwaukee. So even though it's my hometown, this has really become home for me in a very short period of time. I've found the region to be remarkably hospitable. People here are just very kind, welcoming, really took me into their hearts and into their lives right away.
So they're trying to keep you kind of in and around Chicago. They had you north, and now they kind of got you south of Chicago, trying to...
Yeah. Tendency today is to appoint bishops from the region, region of the country. I think they found that for all of our homogenization as a nation, there's still regional differences. So to appoint a Southerner to be Bishop of Boston or a New Englander to be Bishop of Cleveland, you know, there's still regional nuances. So
that would make a lot of sense.
It does.
And this, I never thought about this before, but this region has a lot of similarities to a lot of things going on in Milwaukee. It's
yeah,
an industrial city. And
that's right. In industry, very ethnic, very blue collar. What you see is what you get, hardworking, down-to-earth people. That's what I'm used to. So coming here, I just felt like I was stepping into another Milwaukee in many ways.
Wow. So what, as you've been here, you know, what do you see as some of the challenges kind of facing you, you know, when you mm-hmm. get up every morning, you know, what are you thinking about?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the number one challenge for me as a bishop is just how do we effectively preach the gospel of Jesus Christ to today's age. So the word of God, Jesus' message is perennial. I mean, we have the text of the scriptures, we have the tradition of the church, we have these changeless teachings in a sense. But when you study the history of the church, we've always needed to adapt how we communicate that to the current age in which we live. You know, so how people live today, how we express ourselves culturally, socially, economically, politically, sexually, is different than 100 years ago, as is different 500 years ago, as is different in Africa as it is from Europe or here. So the challenge is always, how do we incarnate the gospel to the people that are right here? So, you know, we do that institutionally, you know, through our parishes, our schools, Catholic Charities, our hospitals. But, you know, how do we make God's love for people real?
Because you're right, the world is changing, yeah. Things are changing, and so it is a different place. Mm-hmm. So we see through those changes a decline in almost all the mainline Christian churches. I mean, yeah. Attendance, participation is down, membership is down significantly, right. In a lot of the churches. How do you kind of, what's the failing or what's going on? I won't say it's a failing. Yeah. What's going on?
I think it's complex. So I think the temptation to give a simple answer to that question is probably incomplete. So there's many factors in it. But certainly we're experiencing just a fundamental shift in how folks relate to institutions in general, I think, whether that's educational institutions, healthcare, government, religion. I think there's a crisis of institution. I think just the internet explosion, the social media explosion, has certainly changed how people relate to each other in terms of community or social organization. So I think what's happening to organized religion is part of something far bigger. I think many people today would say, I'm spiritual but not religious, which really speaks to kind of that individuation that I have a relationship with God, perhaps, as I understand God to be, but I don't really need church. Which is another way of saying I really don't need a community that's bigger than me.
Do you think this challenge to institution has been going on a long time, or it's kind of like the past 10 years? Or
I think it's longer than that. I think it's certainly been percolating longer than that. And as much as Americans like joining things, we also have a strong sense of individualism. You know, so to say that, yeah, I'm going to essentially submit my will and my heart and my life to the authority of a church or of the gospel is sometimes hard for us as Americans, right? But also, I think, to be honest, we need to point to the failings of people in the church. You know, when we look at certainly the clergy sex abuse crisis, when we look at, have we really reached out to people that are disaffected from the church? How do we evangelize? How do we teach people the faith? So we need to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, what can we do better to really engage people in the faith? I found, both as a pastor and now as a bishop, people are amazingly receptive to God and to Christ and to spiritual conversations. So we need to change the paradigm a little bit and perhaps just start asking the right questions to elicit within them this realization that they need God, or that deep down they're really seeking God whether they know it or not.
You've been thinking about this a lot, haven't you?
Probably the last 40 years.
Right. Does it keep you awake?
Sometimes I am tempted to worry and to fear. There's times I go out to do Mass at one of our parishes and I look around, and if you factored out everybody over the age of 65, who's left? And yet I trust that God is doing something new in the church and perhaps calling us to a deeper fidelity and to a deeper embrace of imagination. You know, how do we reimagine living the gospel and embracing the faith? G.K. Chesterton, who is a noted British Catholic commentator, said, Christianity can never be condemned yet because it has never yet been fully tried. I love that, because 2,000 years feels like a long time, but in God's time, it's just the wink of an eye. So we may be just at the very kindergarten of beginning to understand the implications of Christ.
Now, it's interesting. We're taught in the Christian faith, you know, not to worry, not to fear. Mm-hmm. And you said, I worry. I have fears about things. So we're taught not to have those. So how do you respond to that?
I would just respond by saying I'm a human being. So like anybody else, I have fears, I have anxieties, I have things that keep me up at night. But when we feel that, you know, the response of faith draws us to the Lord and to trust in Him, but not just a trust with hands folded, but a trust with hands ready to do the work and minds ready to think and ready to move in new directions.
I want to go back to this institution piece that you talked about, because I think it's fascinating. I've always had this theory that the American public has kind of challenged institutions time and time again. Mm-hmm. I think way back to the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. we challenged the military establishment, and then we challenged big industry, and then we challenged the automotive industry. And I mean, we've just kind of gone through, we've challenged, now we're challenging government. And mm-hmm. it seems like there are cycles to that. Is it possible that the church will come out of some of this, where this will be a cycle of the challenge will make the church better, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden we'll say the church doesn't seem to be being kicked in the teeth as strongly as it was mm-hmm. before? Do you think that's a cycle that'll happen?
I believe so. I am a student of history, and when you study the first 5 centuries of Christianity and you look at the collapse of the Roman Empire, and I imagine trying to be a Christian in that moment, it must have felt like the world was coming to an end. And yet the dissolution of all that those folks knew actually became the crucible for a new whole way of being church and a new whole way of living. It was the crucible, really, of Western civilization and Christendom. So Henry Nouwen, who is a noted Catholic theologian, calls it creative disintegration, which is kind of a polite way of saying everything is currently a mess. The analogy he uses is, imagine a child playing with blocks, and at first she builds a tower, and then she knocks the tower down in order to build a house. There's that moment when the tower's been knocked down and the house isn't yet built, and there's just blocks scattered everywhere. So I think anytime you go through a fundamental paradigm shift in culture, we feel uneasy because the old certainties no longer work, and we don't yet have new responses. So I think we're in one of those moments, but it's a creative moment for us to really do new things.
One of the main criticisms, particularly of the Catholic Church, is it's that tower that's built, mm-hmm. and it can't be knocked down, mm-hmm. or it can't be damaged severely. Mm-hmm. There's got to be times that you're like, I don't know if I agree with all this. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, there's times I'm at a meeting or something complex that we're facing, and inwardly I ask myself the question, did Jesus really intend it to be this complicated? And usually the answer in my mind is no. But then another part of me says, but we need institutions in order to carry forth ideas and fulfill missions. So institutions are good, but they need to be constantly reformed, analyzed, and we need to constantly go back to the original mission, because the temptation becomes to sustain the structure without analyzing the question, does it still serve the mission or not?
Are you able to ask that question?
I am, in many ways. And we're doing that. We had a diocesan synod last year, which is a process of prayer, conversation, decision, planning, to really create a long-range strategic pastoral plan to help our parishes, our schools, our social service agencies, our people, to really grow in the faith and to be dynamic. Because we don't want to just survive. We don't want to just hang on by our fingertips. We want to flourish. So to do that, we need to be creative and to say not all things are set in stone. You know, it's not said in Luke's gospel that this is the only way of having a parish, or there must always be a school in this place. Doing mission work helped me greatly in that regard, because I experienced living, breathing Roman Catholicism in another culture and language. And I realized that many of the things that I thought were essential to faith expression were really culturally conditioned. And so there's a balance of what's of essence to the faith in terms of scripture, tradition, sacrament, moral values and teachings, and what's culturally conditioned. How can this be lived in a different way?
When you think about these things, particularly the changes that may need to happen, and you propose those or even throw out some of these challenging questions, Do you feel the institution sometimes pushes back?
Sometimes. We instinctively cling at times to what we know, and we fear what we don't. In many ways, Pope Francis, I think, is helping us to look at the gospel and the church in a different lens. And again, the tension is, how do we remain true to the tradition and to the teachings? But given that we live in 21st century, you know, postmodern technology age, how do we express that faith? I think many people, those that are still highly engaged in the church, realize that we can't do the same things in the same way and expect different results. So I see a slow but steady conversion of thinking regarding that question.
Now, a lot of people listening to this, particularly the Protestants, would probably say, this guy doesn't sound very Catholic, because I think they expect kind of this Catholic defense of the institution. Mm-hmm. You don't sound very Catholic.
I love the church. I would give my life for the church. But the church is not simply an institution. We would say it's the mystical body of Christ, and a body that's alive with the Holy Spirit. So as we know, any living organism is going to change, evolve, emerge. It doesn't mean that it radically breaks with the past. And so I consider myself a conservative traditional bishop, actually. But to preserve the tradition, we always need, in a sense, another renovation of it in order to keep it lively and fresh. It doesn't mean changing it. It means, how do we engage another generation in the beauty and the mystery and the truth and the goodness and the beauty of Christ?
If you could pray for that lightning bolt to strike, mm-hmm. and ask God to say, man, would you send a bolt of lightning and just change this thing? What would be that one thing you would just say, change this?
Essentially, it would be this, Keith, that we could help people realize how much God loves them and help them to see that religion is this divine romance where we're called to fall in love with God. And once we do that, religion stops being this heavy obligation of something I have to do. And instead, it becomes this living relationship of love with the one who made us, saves us, and calls us to himself for all eternity. So really, this life is simply to learn how to do what we hope to do perfectly in heaven, and that is love God with all our mind, heart, and soul. So my one prayer for all of us, including me, is that we would just continue to fall in love with God. I realize that the institution and the structure is simply there to help us do that, and to find the Lord and allow the Lord to find us. That would be it.
You seem like a really positive person, and I realize your faith calls you to be positive, mm-hmm. but a lot of people of faith aren't. Mm-hmm. Why are you this way?
I think I try to love God, and I look at life as a gift and a mystery, number one. Number two, no one is attracted to crabbiness or to pessimism. So, I mean, no one looks at a person that's always negative and critical and says, I want more of that, or I want to be that.
That's a good point.
So when we fall in love with God, life becomes beautiful. We realize it for what it is, and the glass is always more than half full for me. And even if there's troubles, difficulties, trials, it's just there to help us grow and become even better.
I've always thought, probably the same as you, it's just so simple. I always think that moment you might meet Christ, that he would say, what's wrong with you people? It was just so simple.
Yeah.
You made it so complex.
That's right.
You think that's probably where he would go?
I think so. I wonder if God will ask us at the end of our lives, you know, I gave you 7,862 sunsets. How many did you enjoy? Or I gave you this whole life. What did you do with it? You know, did you live it just quietly for yourself, or did you live it for others? So I don't want to waste 1 second of life, because it is so precious, it's so short, and we're here for just a little time to do something beautiful for God.
So how long do you think you'll be here in this role?
I'm forever, probably till I'm 75. Being a bishop, you never know. I could be here the rest of my life. I could be moved next month. So it challenges me to live in the here and now, because that question is really out of my hands. So I never really even think about it.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I think the people of your churches are glad you're here. And I love your attitude and all that you shared with us. So thanks for being here today.
It's a privilege to be with you, Keith, and to share with your listeners some thoughts. Thank you.
You bet.
Lakeshore Focus airs on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and it's rebroadcast Sunday mornings at 9:30 a.m. on Lakeshore PBS. A section of I-65 in South Lake County is being improved for everyone who travels that highway. Matt Deitchley with NDOT's LaPorte District Office was with us on Regionally Speaking not long ago to explain why the highway needs an additional travel lane and for improved bridges at the Kankakee River.
Folks who drive 65 frequently realize that there's a whole lot of traffic on that roadway. And, you know, the goal of NDOT is to obviously maintain safety and mobility at all time. So, you know, it's been a desire to expand a lane as far as we can go on I-65 for quite some time now. And we're fortunate that this project is underway right now. So we're just beginning year two of the lane expansion project for I-65 between U.S. 30 and just south of State Road 2. So, you know, it's the length of that we were able to go on this project. We're always looking to do more at some point in the future. But I think it's going to be a real benefit to folks in the area from a congestion standpoint. And obviously, that always benefits safety as well.
From what NDOT has looked at over the years, how long has it been, I guess, sort of on the drawing board that something needed to be done about all the added traffic on I-65?
Sure, you know, it's been a desire, obviously, since obviously you can see the congestion on the roadway. So, you know, there's been many years where this has been a desire to find a solution to that and add some lanes out there. And so we're looking forward to the project and being complete at the end of this in the fall. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be something that's going to be really beneficial. But, yeah, obviously congestion, as I said, folks who drive on that area know there's a lot of traffic out there, and this is going to benefit that.
Well, take us through the process that NDOT goes through if they come up with an idea like this. And, you know, they obviously are going to try to do what they possibly can within the literal footprint of the road itself. They don't want to have to buy any more right-of-way if they don't have to. But, obviously, they make some adjustments. So what kind of, behind-the-scenes procedures does NDOT have to go through before they get to the point that they are able to announce the project?
Sure. Now, every project is different. There are surfacing projects, and there's added travel lane projects on lots of different roads. But a road of the caliber of I-65 is going to be substantially more challenging due to the traffic that's already on there during the actual construction of it. But also, acquiring land is the biggest challenge for a lot of expanded highways in lots of areas because you have to buy the land, and there's a lot that goes into that. There's also utility relocation. So it can be a very lengthy process to expand a highway. The fortunate side for I-65 in this area is we already had the width in the shoulder area for the project limits of this project. So there wasn't any right-of-way to buy, and that always expedites the project. But it's still a substantial cost to do a project like this. So, you know, the governor, obviously, this was something that he was definitely behind, and he was here for the groundbreaking on this last year. So, you know, it's definitely a priority in that respect for NDOT as well. So that was the benefit. The biggest benefit for this project is that, you know, all that width was still there in the shoulder area, and so it's just a matter of taking those shoulders and making them road ready. So it's a substantial project, but a little more less challenging than it would be typically for added traveling where you would have to buy property.
Do you think that it was possible that maybe when they designed this section of I-65, and it was a long time ago, obviously, that maybe they just put that in, they might have to do some expansion someday, and they thought, well, we might as well get the right-of-way purchased and have all that ready. And in this case, they actually got things built, I guess, part of the way for the shoulders so they could have that extra expansion room.
Yeah, that's correct. Typically, when we do roadways, you know, we always are looking to the future. So if we expect a road to have added capacity needed, you know, we will do that. I wasn't around when this road was built specifically with NDOT, so I don't know off the top of my head if that was the design, but I would not be surprised if that was the plan in place. They're very wide shoulders here, which isn't typical for a lot of roadways. So, you know, I would be pretty confident in saying that was part of the planning, but it worked out very well.
Well, I was going to ask you if the situation is that I know this project basically ends just about at, I guess, State Road 2 or actually points south to the Kankakee River bridges, because that's all part of the project too. I wonder if maybe over a time, and we know we've talked about this before, that, and you mentioned too just now, that there's likely to be some future expansion in other places on I-65 to the south when they possibly can, but they may have to buy some extra land, I suppose, in some of these places when they go further down. And I wonder if the case was if you're talking with your colleagues further south down around Lafayette, because they did the major expansion of I-65 down around Lafayette and the West Lafayette exits there, I'm sure they probably had to buy some land to be able to make room for that work.
Sure, and that one I'm not aware of outside of my district, but I do know, you know, we are still planning ahead with this project, yeah, too. So, like we said, the project goes just south of State Road 2. So the Kankakee River Bridge there, we're also rehabbing the Kankakee River Bridge while we're down there. But while we're doing that, we're expanding that bridge. So the bridge needs to be rehabbed anyway. So we're adding that to part of the project. But while we're down there, we're making sure that bridge is wide enough so that down the road, when we are able to expand I-65 further south, then that bridge will already be ready to accommodate that. So, you know, the worst thing we want to do is rehab that bridge and have it not be the width proper for added travel lanes when that day comes that project would happen. So we're planning ahead in that way as well.
Now, when we're talking about the bridges over the Kankakee River, and you mentioned that they're going to have to be rebuilt, I suppose, are they going to try to accommodate for the fact that they're so low now, and we know there are problems on US 41, I mean, in the Kankakee River area, as we've seen with our recent flooding. If it's this way, they could get the bridges higher, so there might be less chance of having any problems on I-65. We've been lucky, I guess, we haven't any flooding problems there, but it could possibly happen, couldn't it?
Sure, you know, that's something that all of our engineers and the planning that goes into these projects, they do that ahead of time. So they look at, you know, have we had any issues of high water there? Would those bridges need to be higher for any reason? I don't believe that's the case in these bridges situation. But, you know, that's all part of the process when we plan for a new road or a new highway or just resurfacing a roadway is what issues have we had out there and are we able to alleviate them? So that's all part of the planning process.
Right. If you will take us through the process right now, how things stand on, I guess, on you mentioned in general how the project is going to work, stretching south from U.S. 30 all the way down to the Kankakee River, basically. What's the process as far as the construction work that's underway? It's still in phases, is it not?
It's a two-year project. Right now we're gearing up to do the construction throughout the year. So what you're going to find is, especially during the overnight hours, they're going to be essentially staging for all the work that's going to happen this year. So there's going to be some changing traffic patterns. There's going to be some lane closures in the overnight hours so they can get everything set up for when we have a complete change traffic pattern on certain areas where they're working, then that's prepared to do that. So we obviously do as much work as we can in the overnight hours to not have an impact to traffic and also for the safety of both drivers and our workers.
Matt Eichley with NDOT says the I-65 expansion project will be completed this fall, 18 months sooner than first planned. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Day, and that means we'll have in to talk about the stories they've worked on. Meredith Coleus-Pete from the Post Tribune, John Gard from the LaPorte Herald-Argus and the Michigan City News-Dispatch, and from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Joseph Pete, along with Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson. Hope you can join us.